Hey everyone, welcome to another episode of the Caged Vision podcast. And I have got a very, very special guest for you today. It's the first time we've had a general of any sort with us on the show. And so I'm super excited to have Brigadier General Sean Campbell on the show. He is has had a 26 and a half, almost 27 year career with the Air Force. Is that correct, General Campbell?
Actually, it's a little longer than that. I'm going into nearly 29 years now.
Oh, my goodness, 29 years. So, General Campbell, on the show, as we have talked about, it's called the Caged Vision Podcast because we are helping leaders unpack their caged vision. And that is a vision that they have to grow their organization, to grow an area of an organization. And while it's crystal clear in their head, they could use some tips and some lessons learned from leaders who have been successful in this. So our goal is just to have two or three takeaways. And so I'm so thankful that you have agreed to be on the show. And why don't we start with in the Air Force, when was the first time you were charged with a leadership role? When you were charged with not just following a process that has been established and been refined, but actually implementing change?
First, Kerry, let me say thanks for giving me the opportunity to be with you. I'm excited about this. And as we discussed prior to going live, I love the idea of caged vision and really being able to unlock the opportunities that we have to do things differently. And for me, that started very early in my career. Shortly after I was newly commissioned as a second lieutenant, I was charged with an organization, a part of the organization that had 60 people in it. The incumbent had been gone for several months. And the best way for me to say this is that that part of the unit was failing. And my new commander, my new supervisor, gave it to me, said, okay, I think these are management and leadership issues. You have an undergraduate degree in management, so go fix that problem. Right away, I had to begin to learn about what we call an activity inside the U.S. Air Force that I had never been exposed to. So one, I had to learn what that part of the organization was responsible for doing in the first place, and then recognizing that they needed to change the way that they are actively doing things in order to get the positive effects that we needed to get after. And so right away, I was charged with, you have to change an organization. And many of the members of that organization had been there for years. So very similar to, I think, any other change management effort, you had to start with, I have to get people to buy into what we're trying to do. So here is the intended outcome. Here are the reasons why we need to reach for that outcome, why the change is necessary in the first place, and help me understand how things operate currently. And from your perspective, what are the things that need to improve in order to get to the outcomes that we desire? So it was really that idea of classic change management principles being applied, where you state the problem, you state the outcomes, you get buy-in from the men and women that are going to have to effectuate the change, and then you walk with them through the change. I couldn't just sit in my office and say, go do. They had to know that I was willing to proverbially roll up my sleeves and be an active participant in making those changes. And we had some stumbles, like you would imagine, along the way. But I'm reminded of Winston Churchill having once quipped that courage is going from failure to failure without losing enthusiasm. So you just had to stay focused on, we're going to have some fails, and it's okay for us to do that. The failure's on me, not on you. And let's pick up and keep going forward. And after about 6 months, we got there. So that I would say we went from the red zone into the green zone, and we did lose some folks along the way. I didn't force anyone out. I want to be clear about that. But sometimes you're changing, and men and women who have done things for a period of time, they don't realize that they've atrophied. I've long held this thought pattern that if you aren't growing and you aren't evolving and you aren't improving, you're not standing still. You're actually moving backward because everybody else is moving away from where that line of stasis was.
Wow, that is so good. So as you came in, I love that you said, okay, what are the outcomes and effects that we need to see, and then establish a baseline. Sounds like the baseline came from conversations where you just went into that learning exercise. As what were the strategies that you looked to implement to achieve the outcomes and effects that you wanted? And 6 months, by the way, is fast. That's amazing to start to see results. But what did you implement? You said you failed a few times, but what did you implement, and how did you know when the strategies that you were implementing weren't working?
This part of the enterprise is financially driven. And so it was easier, I think, to set specific concrete goals because you could align a metric to a financial outcome that you were trying to achieve. And so we had some missteps along the way, in part where I mentioned that some of the failure, of course, was on me. And I mean that not just I would take it, because the leader should take the failures and share the successes with the team. I didn't understand that there are different colors of money inside the Department of Defense. Because I was new, I hadn't yet even been through my training program that would have told me there are different colors of money and how that money gets used. So I used the wrong type of money for procurement for the wrong types of things. So that was a learned lesson. There's a process to unravel that. Unfortunately, the dollars that we were talking about were not in the millions or tens of millions. So it wasn't like I was making a mistake that was creating real problems for the taxpayers. But mostly what we were looking at were financial targets, and then looking at, it's sometimes hard to translate, but I'll say looking at the desires our customers wanted and setting metrics against the outcomes that our customers desired. So some of this was easier to set a vision. It wasn't a grand vision because it's down inside a small part of the enterprise, but it was, these are the things that we need to accomplish in order to meet our mission requirements at a level of satisfaction that our customers desire, and also ensuring that we're good stewards of the resources that we have, because that was a lot of the problem, was we weren't meeting the outcomes our customers asked for us to provide, and we were failing in meeting our financial obligations.
So for those in the commercial world, will you quickly describe color of money?
Yeah, color of money inside the Department of Defense is actually in a couple of different directions. The first is there are dollars that are appropriated by Congress, meaning these are taxpayer dollars that we use to execute mission requirements. We also have what's called non-appropriated funds. These are monies that the Congress does not provide us, and the taxpayer is not responsible for providing. They're internally generated by the Department of, in this case, Department of Air Force, and then those dollars are applied to very specific mission areas. Most of those mission areas are things that impact our families and the recreational programs and other areas where we just don't receive money from Congress. So if you don't have those dollars coming in, there's no budget baseline. You have to generate that revenue, just like a private business has to generate that revenue and then apply it to its activities. So part of that organization was self-generating dollars. Part of it was Congress giving us money. And then inside the money that Congress appropriates, there's different categories for which that money can be spent. So some dollars can go to pay for military personnel salary, for example, and other dollars go to specific acquisitions, and they're different pots of money. So you can't use acquisition money for personnel. So you have to understand, okay, which pots of money or which bank accounts can I pay these bills from, and make sure that you use the right bank accounts for the right things. So in business, if I'm a sole proprietor, I want to make sure that I'm not mixing my household dollars with the business dollars. Those have right. to be accounted for separately. So it's the same sort of thing inside the Department of the Air Force.
Got it. Thanks for that clarification. Okay, so how long did this first leadership role, how long did it last? And why do you think you were picked? No one else wanted.
I think really what it boiled down to was, I'd love to say it was because I had these skill sets and my boss understood I had them. It was really, I was the new person on the block. There was a problem, and I didn't have somewhere else to be applied. So that's that happened maybe by happenstance. I was there and that problem was there. So he was able to put me against that problem.
Yeah.
And I was in that role for not quite a year.
Okay. Wow. That's fast. So I love the fact that he saw something, he or she saw something in you, and you went in and you tackled it head on, and clearly there were lessons learned. So what was the next role, and how did that come about?
The way that things work for military members are that we tend to move, particularly officers, and at that time in my career, about every 2 years, sometimes even faster. I've had a couple of pockets in my career where I've moved every year, which is very challenging for the family. And so
yeah,
if anyone has ever met my wife or meets her, she is a saint for putting up with this, because she's been there for 28 of the 29 years and came in sort of wide open, knowing that this is a different lifestyle.
Yeah.
But I think that each of my positions over time, because of the way that this works, I don't think it's terribly different from industry, where you do well somewhere and then you're given another role with widened responsibilities, maybe more people to manage, more resources to manage, maybe both. And so the way the Air Force is structured is, as you grow in your rank, you typically will move into these higher level positions. So I think that just really the arc of my career has gone that way. It's pretty much been additive. Sometimes my team numbers are smaller, but where you are in the organization moves from very tactical early in your career to at my current position. It's all about strategic, and it has an impact across the entirety of the Department of the Air Force. So it impacts both the Space Force and the Air Force. The things that my team are doing have that impact. It impacts everybody in the Air Force. So it's very different from when I had 60 people and I only really impacted that sphere around me at that particular installation.
Well, what I love about the DOD and the Air Force, and how you guys, even though you said you only had 60 people, and even though you said it was a very small area of the organization, everything is tied back to supporting the mission.
Mm-hmm.
And so even if it's a small area, there's an alignment that happens that what I've witnessed. Can you speak to that a little bit?
I think that's right. I have seen over the years that collectively we've really changed the way that we address exactly what you just described. Most young people, when they come into the Air Force, they don't necessarily see themselves connected to the totality of the enterprise. So if I'm an aircraft mechanic, I'm only thinking about turning the wrenches on that particular aircraft. But what I think has changed over time is we've helped that young person realize that, no, you're not just fixing an engine on an F-16 fighter jet. In the absence of you doing this work, the pilot who flies this plane to do close air support for the Army in Afghanistan can't do his or her job. So you have a direct impact on how we execute the mission at the front end of our business. And that's what it's all about. Our first desire is to deter an adversary from taking action against us or our allies to begin with, but deterrence doesn't always work. And so then there has to be an actual kinetic application of the things that we do. So there's no job in the Air Force that doesn't have a direct impact on supporting our ability to execute our missions at the ugly end of our business. So much so that if I'm somebody who provides childcare in one of our childcare facilities, those are not military members, those are civilians. They understand that in the absence of them being able to care for the warfighter's child, the warfighter can't be doing his or her job. And so we've done a better job over the arc of my career, not because of me, but we've just gotten better at helping people understand their connection to the bigger mission sets.
That is so good. I was listening to a podcast the other day, and I believe it was Dave Ramsey, and someone was talking, I forget who was interviewing him, but we were talking about Dave Ramsey and his organization, and they were at an event, and one of the persons that worked for Dave Ramsey was just in a casual conversation. What he said was, the work that we do is important. and my role contributes to that. And then he went on, and I just thought those two connected sentences are just, they're critical to getting buy-in to the overall mission of the organization, is that there, what we do is important, mm-hmm. and I contribute. And it sounds like that's been a big shift for you guys, or a focus. Is that accurate?
That's accurate. Yes, it's become more of a focus. So we think of it in these terms. I'm an airman in the profession of arms. That's my first statement. I happen to be an airman in the profession of arms who's in the human resource business. So those two are connected, the things that I do day to day. But if you start with the reflection that I'm an airman in the profession of arms, that gives you a broader perspective. And I think we've done better over the course of time at helping airmen see themselves as first an airman in the profession of arms. And then whatever they do, that's their part of what they contribute to the Air Force.
Okay. I want to move forward to a point in your career where you spent a little time at Harvard. Mm-hmm. Talk to me about that experience and how it and what that did for your leadership, for how you viewed and moved forward in leadership.
It's a great question. And I went there as for what we call professional military education. So as a lieutenant colonel at the time, so I went there, we're pushing in on 10 years ago now. And the Air Force's goal was to basically get me to what's called beyond the cloister. It was actually an article that General Petraeus wrote when he was finishing his PhD at Princeton, where he was, actually, I think it's Columbia rather. He wanted us to understand that if we only do military education on military-centric themes, we're only going to get military-centric responses to the thorny problems that we face. So the idea is to prepare me for more senior leader roles, go to one of these private institutions and really unlock understanding broader strategy and how to think more openly about applying things that will resolve strategic problems. And so that year there was marvelous. First of all, it was a program that there was no possibility of failing, but I wanted to fail so I could stay there longer because it was such a marvelous experience. But the idea was I took classes. Mostly you audited the courses, and depending on the professor, they would have you do some of the work, which meant all of the reading. So you'd be prepared for the discussion in the classroom, because that was the biggest portion, was the discussion in the classroom and the idea generation and bouncing things off of one another. And really, if you think about it, the Socratic method of having a debate and having discourse and sharpening one another and broadening your thinking, up to you had to do everything that the professor wanted you to do, meant you had to write the papers and take the exams and that sort of thing, everything in between. During my period of time there, I went through 32 books. So I was there for about 10 months. I read 32 books and somewhere north of 10,000 pages of other material, from single page articles to very scholarly documents, you know, research analyses and that sort of thing. And so it really opened my mind to, there are a whole bunch of other ways to think about the challenges that we have inside the Department of the Air Force. So I think that what it did for me was it helped me think more along the lines of not just at the strategic level, but more along the lines of systems thinking, how things connect one to another. And that matters, of course, at the strategic level where I am now. As I mentioned earlier, the decisions that my team are making or recommendations that we make to the service chief or to the Secretary of the Air Force for implementation, they're going to have impact to the entirety of the Department of the Air Force. And then how the Air Force, by extension, supports the Department of Defense and our combatant commanders in the application of the profession of arms. So it was a good way for me to elevate the way that I saw challenges and opportunities, and to recognize if every problem is a nail, we say a hammer is the right tool, but that's exactly the wrong way to think. I needed, right. So it basically gave me more tools in the toolbox beyond just a military-centric way of thinking.
Very good. Okay, so you talked to me about maybe the biggest challenge that you faced so far, because you obviously went deep and took some time to really think about how you think, and you have different tools now. And then, you get back in the practice of being redeployed into different areas, and you're testing your wife's patience with your moves. but what's sort of been the biggest challenge so far?
I think the biggest challenge so far was probably the position that I most recently left. For the better part of 2 years, I was the Deputy Chief Human Capital Officer for the U.S. Space Force. And I came aboard just weeks after the Space Force became an actual independent service in the Department of Defense. So I was the first person to fill that role. And not only was I the first person to fill that role, at the time, I became the fifth person in the Chief Human Capital Office for the entire Space Force. That was an incredible challenge, because the Air Force had spent a year building a plan to build the Space Force over 5 years. And then Congress said, that's interesting, but you have 18 months to get to initial operating capability. And we had to move incredibly fast in the absence of people to do the work, in the absence of resources to perhaps go out and get support from a independent contract agencies, Boston Consulting Group, Booz Allen, whomever we normally use to help us with these kinds of big projects. So we were on a threadbare budget at the beginning. It got better over time. It's still improving. That was a huge challenge to say, go build a startup military enterprise. We haven't done that for 73 years in this country. So when we stood up the Air Force in 1947. So since that time, we haven't done this. That was an enormous challenge. And early on, my primary focus was not only helping my boss build out our staff here at the headquarters, and so building it out in terms of a new organizational design and construct that we haven't used in the Department of Defense previously. We created parts of the enterprise that look exactly like corporate America, because that made the most sense for us to flatten out the organization, to streamline strategic thinking and decision-making, and to shorten the time it took for us to get approvals from more senior members to do the things that we needed to do.
Hey everyone, we have we had to call an audible here. We were recording and audio got right in the middle of a great story. Audio got a little rough, so we had to bail and relaunch the audio portion of this. So I'll attempt to pick back up where we were. General Campbell, I believe I was asking after your time at Harvard, what was the next big challenge? What was sort of the biggest challenge that you faced, and really had to lean back on those on the time at Harvard to think through a challenge?
Yeah, so we were talking about, I think what has been the biggest challenge so far in my career was when I went over to help stand up the U.S. Space Force, started that opportunity just a few weeks after it was signed into law that we would create the first new service in 73 years. And so there was no playbook. You couldn't just go back to when the Air Force was built out of the Army in 1947 and apply all those lessons learned, because they didn't really exist. Not to say there weren't historical documents, but we were essentially doing a military startup. And how do you do that when you prepared to do so over the course of 5 years, but you're given direction by Congress to do so in a year and a half? So we had to start to think very differently and deeply about, we have real strategic things that we need to do. At the same time that we're still doing day-to-day space missions, we have to build this new organization. So part of what I was doing as the Deputy Chief Human Capital Officer for the Space Force was building the organization here at the Headquarters Space Force. And we did so in a way that is much more corporately aligned, because we looked at the best practices in industry and recognized that a flatter organization would allow you to have a faster decision-making process. And that made a lot of sense for us. The Department of Defense, like many parts of the U.S. government, are incredible bureaucratic machines. And it takes a long time to get decisions made. Well, when you have 18 months to build an organization, you need to move fast. Yeah. So it was purpose-built, but that got us to that idea of, I'm not just going to go back to military centrism, and this is how we do it in the now Department of the Air Force. We were able to say, no, let's go look outside. And I think having the opportunity to think and drink deeply about things outside of the U.S. military, as my Harvard experience allowed, really helped us to be okay with the uncertainty and the ambiguity of doing something different than the traditional way the Department of Defense does things. And we were given the authority to do that. So that, of course, you needed to have that to be able to operate that way. The second big thing that I was asked to do was help develop the talent management strategy for the U.S. Space Force. And so that was the full life cycle, human resource life cycle, from how you recruit to how you develop to how you retain to how you employ and to how you increase connectedness and collaboration across the entire force. And so that was something that was quite new. It's not to suggest that the U.S. Air Force doesn't have a talent management strategy. It's different from what we decided to do in the U.S. Space Force. And so just like building the organizational structure, we were given huge amounts of latitude in how we wanted to focus on the entirety of the talent management lifecycle. And what I shared with General Raymond as the first ever Chief of Space Operations, on my last day working for him inside the Space Force, I said, one of the things I appreciate, sir, is that you never said no to anything we proposed to you. You asked a lot of appropriate probing questions, but once we explained the why behind it, the way that we were recommending we went or would go, you said go. And that was very freeing for us to do that. Here again, if we were only focused down in inside our organization, informed by our own experiences inside the military, and not being more broadly exposed to, there's other and probably better ways for us to do things. And again, going back to the Harvard experience, very comfortable doing things that were uncertain and ambiguous, and not just reaching back to how things have long been done inside the Department of Defense or the Department of Air Force, and just simply applied those principles and programs and policies to how we did things inside the U.S. Space Force. So it was incredibly challenging, but at the same time, it was so richly rewarding to be able to be at the front end of building something truly new and truly unique inside the Department of Defense. So I would say, just sort of closing this thought, it's incredibly gratifying to be a part of that. I was just a very tiny cog in that big wheel, but it was a great experience, and I was able to draw from thinking at a much broader scale and at a strategic level and how that applies all the way to the front end of the things that we do inside the Space Force.
That's great. Coming from your experience in a large organization like the Air Force and building a new organization and intentionally knowing that we have to build this in a way where we don't build silos. We have to start out and be very intentional to not build silos, because in large, any large organization, silos can get built, and that creates complexity and confusion and then that prevents execution. So how did you guys talk to me about how intentional you were to prevent silos in the organization?
This is another really interesting and important question. What you just described, we talked about at the very early days in my time in the Space Force, or serving the Space Force, because I'm still an airman, not a guardian. But we were concerned about creating what we would call the operational silo, meaning that our space operators, the men and women who are flying our satellites and launching our rockets and that sort of thing, that we'd be really focused on that part of the enterprise and not focused on the rest of the guardians. And sometimes in the Air Force, there's a tendency for us to focus on silos. And so we recognized that we can't afford to do that in a service that's going to be as small as the Space Force, because that doesn't help us with collaboration at depth, and that doesn't help us with the connectedness that we need to have at depth. And I'm not castigating my own service. The Air Force is a wonderful place, and we do things exceedingly well. But in an organization as large as the Air Force, it is easy to fall into, I'm just inside my own community, and this is the water's edge. So we thought very specifically about that in space and set up guardrails in terms of the way that we constructed the values inside the core values for the U.S. Space Force. And that one of those is commitment. And that commitment is one to another, not just one to my community. And we created what we call the Guardian Commitment, which is a series of I will statements. So the member has a series of I wills that are connected directly to our values. And then the supervisors of said members have a series of I will statements that they're responsible for fulfilling. And then we hold guardians accountable at both edges of that responsibility. And that's a way for us to move outside of creating silos. And I'm not going to suggest it's perfect because we're still an infant. We don't know what we are going to look like in a few years, but we were deliberate, to your question, to put things into practice inside the what we call the Guardian Ideal, which is our talent management strategy. We were deliberate in putting things inside there and then creating anchors that we would set early to help us culturally move in that direction. So when we bring in new guardians, whether they transfer in from other services, which is where most of our guardians have come from, or we bring them as new recruits, that's where they start. They start with this idea that I'm committed to the Guardian Commitment, which ties me committed one to another. And we also set up ways to ensure that three key things were foundational to the U.S. Space Force. The first is that you have a growth mindset, that you're coming here to continually grow and evolve and learn. Number two, that you have an outward mindset, that you're really focused on making your teammates successful and less focused on making yourself successful on a team. And then the third piece was the idea that Amy Edmondson often talks about as the, if you will, the purveyor, if not perfecter, of psychological safety. That was really important for us to do that inside the entirety of the U.S. Space Force. So when you start with those predicates, it changes the culture in such a way, or anchors the culture in such a way, that you are connected one to another, and you're thinking more fulsomely as opposed to just what do I do inside my own part of the Space Force and in the community where I happen to be assigned.
What a unique and amazing opportunity to be a startup within the DoD. It's just I love hearing that story. Thank you for sharing that. So let's talk, or maybe end with the lessons learned from that Space Force opportunity, and how you've taken those lessons learned, and really the lessons from your career, and applied it to where you are now.
I think it's a great place to end. And I will borrow from Mother Teresa, who said, be faithful in small things, because it is in them that your strength lies. So really what that means for me in translation is taking the culmination of the things that I've learned and through the experiences and the education, and I think I've developed some expertise inside this enterprise and more rounded with looking at private industry and outside of our own cloister, as we talked about earlier, that it's really the things that matter still matter. So the things I did as a second lieutenant that made me successful there, those are still applicable today. It's just that I have grown and developed a bigger tool chest than I had at the earlier part of my career. And so it's remembering that humans are still humans, and they still want to be treated with dignity and respect, no matter how big or thorny the challenge. If you start with, I'm still going to treat people well, I'm still going to take care of their requirements, and I'm still going to care about them because they're going to execute the mission. And I think that is really what I'm driving at, is as I've learned and grown and adapted over time, it's still the application of the right tool at the right time, and it really all begins with humans and recognizing that in the absence of having our guardians or our airmen, or by extension the soldiers, sailors, Marines, Coast Guardsmen that I've worked with over the years, it still starts with those core lessons of small things still matter, and they allow you to be successful in the big things.
Do you feel like, because maybe I'm becoming more aware, or maybe I'm somehow becoming more empathetic, I don't know, but I feel like I'm seeing more of an outwardly statement of be human first. Is it me, or you feel like that's is this something that organizations are starting to realize, that we have maybe over time we've over-processed and we've over-automated and we sort of forgot about the human aspect?
I think that is true. I don't think it's just you. I think that earlier in my career, we used to use this discourse on its mission and people, but mission first. And we would say, well, that's 51% and 49% is taking care of your people. And I think there's been a collective learned lesson that if you take care of the people first, then the mission will take care of itself. So the mission is still important. It's not really a primary balance between the two. It's we, I believe, collectively, not everyone, but on the main, we've come to this point where we recognize you take care of the people first and everything else will follow because they'll trust you, they'll believe in you, they'll be desirous of trying to reach the goals and the outcomes that have been set before them. It reminds me of that old John Maxwell maxim, people don't care about how much you know until they know how much you care about them. And so if you start there, the rest of it takes care of itself.
I cannot think of a better place to close, which has been an amazing podcast. General Campbell, thank you for your time. Thank you for these amazing nuggets that other leaders are going to be able to learn from your experiences, from your success, and from your failures. So thank you for your willingness to share.
My pleasure. Thank you again for having me. This has been a great hour. It's probably the best hour I'm going to have this week.
Well, thanks for saying that. We'll chat soon.
Thanks.